want to welcome you to today's Michiana Adventist Forum presentation. I'm glad you're all at the right place at the right time. Someone told me that they saw it announced for 9 to 11 a.m. this morning. I don't know who came for that. Maybe we lost part of our audience. And there's another error. The PMC bulletin said that the next forum is on April 19. That's a Wednesday. Don't come on a Wednesday. It should be April 29. So put that on your calendar, and we'll get them to correct that. Our speaker today is Dr. Brian Strayer, and the title of his presentation is A History of Adventist Lifestyles, Part 1. Part 2 will come on April 29. And the subtitle, Some Facts, Some Insights, and Some Surprises. Before we get going, let's all stand, and Marvin Budd will offer the opening prayer.
Our Heavenly Father, thank you for the love that you've shown to each one of us. Thank you for giving us the institutions that you've provided for our care. We pray now that the words that we hear and the meditations that we have in result will improve our acceptability of service to you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Just some reminders. If you are not on our email list to announce these meetings, please give us your email address and your phone number along with your name, and we'll include you on our list. We're always grateful for your donations. Looks like we're going to start inviting more speakers to come present to our forum meetings. Please remember us in your giving. I also want to thank all of those who keep the forum happening, especially Kathy Cadell, Jim Hayward, Jim Harris, John Ney, and Bruce Zimmerman. Now let me introduce our speaker for today. Dr. Strayer was born in Waterloo, New York. Waterloo is a good name for a good place for a historian to be born. Waterloo, New York, not Europe. He was the first of three children born to a machinist father and a nurse mother. At the age of six, he moved to with his family to Union Springs, New York. And that was home for him through elementary school, and he also graduated there from Union Springs Academy. Dr. Strayer has 3 degrees in history, a bachelor's degree from Southern Adventist University in 73, a master's degree from Andrews University in 74, and a PhD from the University of Iowa in 1987. He has written 11 books, 120 scholarly and professional articles, and 40 reviews and critiques in French and Adventist history. After 41 years of teaching students from seventh grade to the doctoral level, including 33 years at Andrews University, he retired in 2016. He's in his seventh year of writing a weekly column in the local newspaper, the Journal Era. The column is titled, The Past is Always Present. That's another theme for historians. And he's also a frequent speaker at camp meetings, weeks of prayer, conferences, and churches. He told me he's currently also working on a biography of Hiram Edson. That will be a future forum presentation, I'm sure. And he's also working on a centennial history of Union Springs Academy. They were lucky enough to graduate a historian. Now, more pertinent to today's topic, two events piqued his interest in the history of Adventist lifestyles. In 1981, while working on his dissertation in Paris, He attended the Boulevard Hôpital SDA Church and saw the French pathfinders, which they called Tissons, saluting their flag, and I was going to demonstrate that, but I'm afraid to, saluting their flag with the same stiff-armed salute that the Nazis had used to salute the swastika in Paris 40 years earlier. You know about the salute I'm talking about. Yes. Then in 1990, while teaching history at New Bold College, he saw Norwegian SDA men playing soccer on the recreation field on Sabbath afternoons, something that never happened at Andrews University. These incidents caused him to wonder why Adventists who believed the same 28 fundamental beliefs lived such different lifestyles around the world. Today he will share part one of his research focusing on worship styles, the arts, Sabbath keeping taboos, sports, gambling, novels, theater, and TV. So, Dr. Strayer, some facts, some insights, and some surprises. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you all for coming out today. I hope that what I have to say will not only be enlightening, but also somewhat entertaining, perhaps Adventist Forum Light this afternoon. I'd like to start with the picture that you're viewing there. I think that says a great deal. We see a young Seventh-day Adventist mother in Battle Creek in the 1890s with her young son. And you'll notice the cup of hot drink is labeled Postum, a substitute for coffee for Seventh-day Adventists and for Mormons. In fact, today, Postum is produced not too many miles south of us by Eliza's Quest Foods in Indiana, and the chief consumers of it are Mormons and Seventh-day Adventists, trying to avoid that satanic drink about which I wrote a column a few weeks ago called coffee. And interestingly enough, three-fifths of the workforce producing Postum today are Adventists and Mormons. There's your first surprise in my lecture today. Seventh-day Adventists formed their doctrines and organizational structure before they developed their lifestyle. Like many American-born sects, they were a religious movement in tension with a larger society, not only in their doctrines and institutional structure, but also in their lifestyle. Yet Adventism sank deep roots into several types of religious soil. The Radical Reformation, especially the Anabaptists, bequeathed an emphasis on adult baptism, separation of church and state, and a preference for biblical truth over creeds and traditions. The Methodist heritage included an Arminian view of salvation, conferences, and a general conference presided over by presidents or bishops, an itinerant ministry, including female preachers, revivals and camp meetings, an emphasis on private prayer, heart religion, scripture reading, and ecstatic worship, and strong opposition to dancing, card playing, drunkenness, novels, the theater, and jewelry. Its inheritance from the Millerites, the Advent Christians, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Christadelphians included a focus on apocalypticism, date setting, and plotting end-time events. Thanks largely to the Puritans, Baptists, Disciples of Christ, and the Christian Connection, Adventists inherited a strong vein of primitivism that drove them to seek biblical support for every doctrine, every institution, and every lifestyle they adopted. Likewise, Wesleyan Methodism, Pentecostalism, instilled within Adventists the urge to seek for personal salvation. The interactions among these many inherited elements and between Adventists and the larger society have created four basic streams of Adventism, as defined by Dr. Reinder Brunsma. I seem to be running ahead of myself here. They are mainstream Adventism, evangelical Adventism, progressive Adventism, and historic Adventism. Now, throughout this presentation and part two on April 29, we will see these four streams clashing with one another as we explore various aspects of the Adventist lifestyle. It is also important, I think, to remember that three American religions, Adventism, Mormonism, and Spiritualism, originated within a 50-mile radius of Rochester, New York, in what is known as the Burned-Over District between 1830 and 1850. During this antebellum era, men and women agitated for many reforms: penal, agricultural, educational, marital, dress, health, peace, voting, temperance, and anti-slavery reforms. And Adventists participated in many of these reforms. Yet while the founders Joseph Bates and James White largely shaped the doctrines and organizational structure of Seventh-day Adventism, Ellen White, and this is the earliest photo we have of her in the 1850s, played a formative role in creating the ideal Adventist lifestyle. Born in 1827, Ellen Harmon was one of five female prophets in the city of Portland, Maine. During the Millerite movement of the 1840s, no fewer than 55 American men and women claimed to have the prophetic gift. Well, an additional 200 individuals professed to be seers of future events. Following the great disappointment on October 22, 1844, these three founders inculcated a reformist ideology into the Adventist lifestyle that permeated the movement for decades thereafter. Indeed, as late as the 1880s, Battle Creek College student D.W. Rivas stated, "The whole spirit of the entire denomination was reformatory in every detail of life." At times, however, this mindset engendered fanaticism. Elder Stephen Haskell complained in 1899 that Adventism in Battle Creek provided queer soil for the sprouting of such fanatical ideas as setting new dates for the second coming of Christ, equating angels with the Holy Spirit, forbidding the killing of insects because all life was sacred, advocating for a flat earth, and declaring that those with physical blemishes or white hair could never get into heaven. That would leave out most of us here. At other times, the spirit caused infighting. In 1903, Professor Percy T. McGann told Ellen White that Battle Creek had now become, in his words, a seething, foaming mass of lying reports, unbelief, backbiting, criticism, and disregard for the plain commands of God. But the most prominent manifestation of radical reformation, especially with regard to lifestyle issues, was a tendency toward legalism. As late as the 1920s, the General Conference Home Commission recommended breaking a child's bad habits of thumb sucking, temper tantrums, pouting, snacking, and bedwetting by vigorous spanking and letting the child cry himself to sleep. During the same decade of the 1920s, Adventist boarding academies employed beating and whipping as punishments for misbehaving boys. However, at other times, this urge to reform brought some positive changes, as we will see. In many respects, Adventists resembled three other religious groups in upstate New York: the Shakers, the Mormons, and the Jehovah's Witnesses. After the great disappointment, some 200 Adventists joined the Shaker movement. One of them, in fact, was Elizabeth Temple, whose famous renovating remedy, a cure for cholera, which consisted of bloodroot, spicy cubebs, snake root, brandy, and laudanum made her fabulously wealthy. She shared this recipe with James and Ellen White. In 1842, when Ellen Harmon was 15 years old, her second cousin, Agnes Coolbrith, married the Mormon, Don Carlos Smith. And later, when he died, her second cousin became one of several wives of his more famous brother, church founder Joseph Smith. Throughout their history, Adventists have often been mistaken or maligned as Mormons. The term lying Mormon was applied to James and Ellen White in the Midwest, to Merritt E. Cornell and Moses Hull in Iowa, and to J.N. Loughborough and D.T. Bordeaux in California. Likewise, Adventists continue to be confused with Jehovah's Witnesses to the present day. This is not really surprising, since all three of these groups are American-made religions that arose in the mid-19th century in New York State. They each claim to be the true church. They urge separation from the world. They engaged in door-to-door witnessing. They oppose the use of alcohol, tobacco, coffee, jewelry, and drugs. They forbade premarital sex, and all three promoted predominantly male leaders, despite women being in the majority in their churches. In lifestyle formation, this religious background has made it easier for Adventists to focus on ad hoc standards based on tradition and precedents rather than on principles. In an effort to avoid ghetto formations, such as the Amish have gone through in their isolationism, on the one hand, and assimilation, like the Methodists, on the other hand, Adventists have established bounded sets of rules rather than centered sets based on relationships. A bounded set uses external characteristics, such as the 28 fundamental beliefs, no alcohols, no smoking, no pork, no jewelry, etc., to differentiate Adventists from other Christians. A bounded set sees theology as unchanging truth. It keeps accurate membership roles. It emphasizes evangelism, that is, conversions, over discipling or nurturing. It focuses on its differences with other denominations, and it expects converts to follow a Western Adventist way of doing things. By contrast, a centered set that focuses on relationships places Jesus, not doctrines, at the center, recognizes variations among members, affirms differences in race, ethnicity, culture, and worship styles, finds discipling both restorative and redemptive when it goes hand in hand with evangelism, sees baptism as one's profession of faith rather than an intellectual assent to doctrines, and gives more authority to local and national leaders who demonstrate God's power in their lives. Adventists who model the bounded mindset soon created a shared descriptive vocabulary of hundreds of terms aptly named Adventees by Dr. Jane Thayer, who is with us today, that distinguished Adventist insiders from non-Adventist outsiders. How many Methodists and Baptists, for example, know what Adventists mean by the term social bound, haystacks, and the truth? Or will catch the double entendre in the term lay activities? Perhaps, Jane, it's time to update your list. It's been several decades now. Regarding the Sabbath, even after unanimity had been reached that the seventh day is God's holy Sabbath, wide disagreement arose over the time and the manner of keeping it. Pioneer Joseph Bates argued the 6 p.m. Friday to 6 p.m. Saturday time because that was the uniform time at the equator. Others favored midnight Friday to midnight Saturday. Still others adopted a sunrise to sunrise schedule. Not until further Bible study by J.N. Andrews in 1855 were most Adventists convinced to keep the day holy from Sunset Friday to Sunset Saturday. And even then, there were two who held out, Joseph Bates and Ellen White. It appears that John and Mary Loughborough in Battle Creek were the first Adventist couple to observe the Sabbath from Friday night sundown to Saturday night sundown. This legalistic mindset helped Adventist evangelists attract huge crowds for debates with Sunday keeping ministers that could last for weeks at a time in the 19th century. It also inspired the Whites to remind believers that the Sabbath was a time for worship and not for work or play. Therefore, they should guard the edges of the Sabbath. James White called the Sabbath our dear friend. Ellen saw it as a memorial of creation. But how should one observe holy time? The Millerites had favored holy prostrations, leaping, weeping, shouting, hellfire sermons, and visionary experiences in their worship services. Beginning in 1844, some Adventists practiced holy hugs and holy kisses, noisy singing, crawling on the floor, and foot washing. Ellen White, whose father was an exhorter, came from the shouting Methodist tradition. She favored a charismatic worship style that included vigorous singing, shouting, weeping, public visions, confessions, and testimonies. By contrast, James White, whose father was a vocal teacher, came from a Christian connection background. He preferred carefully reasoned discourses and harmonious singing. Both James and Ellen, however, accepted glossolalia, speaking in tongues, as a divine manifestation during Pentecostal-style worship services. Between 1848 and 1899, Richard Ralph in New York and Maine, Ezra Chamberlain, ahead of myself here, in Connecticut, Washington Morse in New York, and several individuals at the Holy Flesh camp meetings in Indiana spoke in tongues. Well, others interpreted what they said. But when Ralph Mackin in 1908 claimed to have the gift of tongues, the gift of prophecy, and the gift of exorcism, Ellen White charged him with fanaticism and disorder, noise and confusion, eccentricities of action, and strong exercisings that were not from God. Millerite camp meetings featuring cheerful testimonies, fervent preaching, vigorous singing, and shouting exclamations also set the pattern for Sabbatarian Adventist gatherings. However, camp superintendents and the Adventist tendency to give two-hour biblical discourses soon made Adventist camp meetings more orderly. Likewise, Ellen's admonition to preachers not to pound the pulpit, to shout, or to contort their bodies added respectability to late 19th century worship services. Yet Adventist camp meetings did not at first catch on in Australia, England, and Europe due to their American associations. Also, the regional wet climates, local poverty, upper class prejudices, and their circus associations. After the 1920s, when conferences ceased moving the tents around and established permanent campgrounds, they largely ceased to be evangelistic and became in-house revivals, a development which General Conference President Arthur G. Daniels deeply regretted. As the decades passed, special camp meetings welcomed Adventists from many diverse backgrounds and lifestyles. Camp meetings for African Americans, for Hispanics, for Native Americans, for retirees, for LGBTQ+, for RV folks, and yes, Rick, even for cowboys. Diversity among attendees, quickly led to diversity in worship styles as well, especially at the weekly Sabbath school and church services. Some congregations preferred a liturgical service that appealed both to the mind and the senses and included robed choirs, introits, anthems, intercessions, responses, chanted psalms, congregational singing, incense, candles, and short homilies. Others preferred more the celebration format, focusing on love, grace, and praising God by singing exuberant choruses accompanied by electrical guitars and drums. Worshippers created deeply moving symphonies, paintings, sculptures, and dramas, and they reached out to the larger community with service-oriented projects. A few congregations adopted Jewish practices, including special candles, silver, tablecloths, china, flowers, music, poetry, fragrant herbs, select foods, singing praise songs, laughter, study, and prayer. Whatever the worship style, however, several studies and surveys have raised concerns about declining church attendance and rising dropout rates among Adventist youth. And since Jerry Thayer is here and he loves statistics, I thought I would throw a few in just for him. One study in the 1990s revealed that only 75% of Adventist youth attended church weekly. Only 57% of them held a church office, and 40% of them rarely or never witnessed about their beliefs with a non-Adventist. Another survey of 1,523 teens in 659 congregations between 1987 and 97 found that between 40 and 50% of baptized youth left the church by their mid-20s. However, a third and somewhat more encouraging study of Hispanic youth discovered that over 57% of them had daily devotions, 60% had a balanced understanding of the gospel, 95% held orthodox doctrinal views, and 85% considered the Sabbath very meaningful in their lives. Many others who deplored the church's emphasis on doctrines and standards as guilt-inducing sought a worship experience based on warmth, acceptance, and relationships. Recent critics have suggested that in light of these studies, the church needs to place more emphasis on spiritual renewal, adopt the methods of the Willow Creek Church, reach out to the community, and grant members greater flexibility in choosing doctrines and lifestyles that fit their needs. John Hewson, an Adventist pastor in 2006, who spent several weeks in a Greek Orthodox monastery on Mount Athos, overlooking the Aegean Sea, sought spiritual renewal through prayer, silence, meditation, and a strict vegetarian regimen. He recommended this to all Adventist pastors facing burnout. One's choice of worship styles also reflects one's aesthetic values, and in the realm of art, architecture, and sculpture, Adventists have been largely utilitarian. Like Martin Luther, who used black and white woodcuts as graphical sermons to teach apocalyptic lessons, and like their Millerite progenitors, who printed woodcuts and engravings of the images of Daniel and Revelation on cloth charts, Adventists in the 1850s used lithographs in the Advent Review and Sabbath Herald to illustrate their views of God's law, the beasts of Daniel and Revelation, and the plan of salvation. Review editor Uriah Smith created woodcuts for the youth's instructor to illustrate stories. By the 1880s and 90s, Adventist periodicals featured black and white cartoons depicting temperance and anti-Catholic themes. And with Ellen White's encouragement, evangelists began creating paper mache beasts that gripped audiences' attention and gave little children vivid nightmares. Yet such didactic uses of art did not foster art programs in Adventist colleges. until Pacific Union College in California offered the first art courses in the 1880s. Other Adventist colleges followed after 1900. But art departments did not really exist in Adventist colleges until the 1950s. Likewise, early church architecture was also utilitarian. Reflecting their Puritan roots, Adventists erected wooden rectangular meeting houses with a tower or belfry, Federal-style moldings, and tall windows for natural light. Their plain beauty emphasized order, function, and neatness. Later congregations built Victorian chapels with side towers and Gothic windows. In 1879, Adventists in Battle Creek erected the so-called Dime Tabernacle, a brick edifice seating 3,000 members with a belfry, balconies, and a huge clock donated by the citizens of Battle Creek. Not until the 1920s, however, did other congregations build classical, Federal, or Greek Revival chapels of brick, and despite Ellen White's earlier objections, some Gothic churches with towers, steeples, arched windows, and spires. While traveling in Europe between 1885 and 1887, Ellen visited several Gothic cathedrals. She strongly disapproved of their dungeon-like chill that suggested torture to her. "A more dismal place I do not wish to see," she exclaimed, calling Gothic cathedrals relics of the Dark Ages, as if priests and people had been asleep for hundreds of years. She expressed similar disdain for rosaries, incense, confessional booths, and the Mass. Once again, Adventist emphasis on economy, simplicity, and utility forestalled the training of professional architects until Andrews University established an accredited degree program in 2003. Furthermore, some Adventist artists had to contend with church leaders who associated painters with loose morals. Such was the experience of the young Harold Weiss, when his mother enrolled him in the Escuela de Bellas Artes in Buenos Aires, Argentina, much against the objections of local church elders. But several developments in the 20th century helped to change Adventist negative views of the creative arts. Beginning in the 1950s, Betty Lucan's 600 full-color felts, illustrating 182 Bible lessons, sold over 1,000 sets internationally every single year, shaping baby boomers' views of Bible characters. These Sabbath school felts were in turn based on the colorful biblical art of Adventist pioneers Clyde Provancha, Jim Arribaud, and Harry Anderson that illustrated Arthur Maxwell's popular 10-volume Bible story set, published between 1951 and 1958, and widely distributed by Adventist book and Bible houses and call porters. Beginning in the 1960s and 70s, artists Ken Mead, Greg Constantine, and Nathan Green produced art books depicting Christ in contemporary settings. Sculpture found little expression until the 1960s and 70s, when Alan Collins began depicting abstract and biblical themes with sculptures of creation, and the J.N. Andrews family at Andrews University, and the Good Samaritan on the campus of Loma Linda University. Recent Adventist critics have advocated greater church support for painting, drama, film, dance, literature, and music that restore God's image in humanity, bear witness to God's creativity, reflect the diversity of biblical literature, emphasize feelings and not just intellectual beliefs, and enrich people's lives. Recent accomplishments in this vein include the comic book Bible, which uses comic book art and words to illustrate Bible stories for children. The manga Bible, which features lots and lots of humor. And the brick Testament, which utilizes Lego block art created by Brendan Powell Smith. Likewise, in 2016, Spectrum featured a half-century display of art in 10 different media by 50 artists from seven nations in its volume 44, number 2 issue. Now, once Adventists determined the proper day, time, and place for worship, church leaders next discussed the proper way to observe the day. Attending Sabbath school, church, prayer, and testimony meetings topped the list of public activities. But the Whites also recommended Bible study, nature walks, missionary visits, and hymn singing at home. Church school and family picnics and potlucks were also acceptable. A century later, Fanny Houck's 1987 book, Beyond Baptism, What the New Believers Should Know About Adventist Lifestyle, recommended attending Sabbath school and church, studying the Bible, taking nature walks, listening to spiritual music, visiting nursing homes, and distributing religious literature. Reading church periodicals, attending missionary volunteer and Pathfinder meetings, joining sunshine bands, and going on campouts were also on her approved list. To protect its sacredness, church leaders forbade certain activities on Sabbath. Since the 1860s, Adventist conscientious objectors in the military have been forbidden to work on Sabbath, even if ordered to do so. Members were urged not to read secular literature, to attend school or work on that day. Yet blue laws in America and Europe penalized Adventists who worked on Sunday. During the 1880s and 90s, dozens of Adventists were fined, jailed, or put on chain gangs, as you see here in the South, for working on their farms, running printing presses, and operating other business enterprises on Sunday. Similarly, many continental parents of children who refused to attend school on Saturdays were subject to heavy fines or jail terms. As many of you realize, I'm sure, the European school week, even today, is Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, with Wednesdays off. Some Sabbath taboos were culturally based. Jamaicans, for example, did not perform baptisms on Sabbath. In tropical Brazil, with the humidity and temperatures in the 90s, men always wore ties, but no beards. Women wore long-sleeved dresses. And nobody played electric organs in church on Sabbath. Yugoslavian youth could not swim, ski, boat, shave, shower, window shop, or listen to secular music on Sabbath. American boarding academy teens were forbidden to bicycle, swim, play ball, chew gum, or shower on Sabbath. Paradoxically, however, many baby boomers here today remember that it was permissible to wade up to one's knees, to run and play as long as one did not kick a ball, to chew gum, to hike for miles, and to overindulge at potlucks on Sabbath. Because, after all, these were Sabbath calories and did not count. In the 1980s, Fanny Houck's manual for new converts forbade shopping, house cleaning, secular reading, listening to the radio, watching TV, and doing homework on Sabbath. As attacks on American churches, mosques, and synagogues increased in the late 20th and early 21st century, some Adventist congregations debated the pros and cons of arming their deacons. Others chose to create hospitality statements to make everybody feel welcome. Printed in bulletins, posted on entrance walls, and added to websites, these hospitality statements celebrated racial gender, ethnic, and sexual orientation diversity, described church as a safe place to grow, defined the Christian life as a journey of exploration, church fellowship as belonging to a family, and exalted grace, love, and hope above law, requirements, and restrictions. The rise of Adventism in the 19th century coincided with the growth of team sports, bare-knuckle boxing, and the bicycle craze in America. But Ellen White called boxing and football schools of brutality and condemned bicycles, which could cost as much as $125, roughly 4 months' wages for a working man, as an extravagant expense. Having given up checkers, chess, and backgammon as a girl, Ellen condemned games and sports for fostering rivalry and idolatry. She called them unholy amusements, foolish pleasures, a waste of time, and even satanic in their origin. Specifically, she opposed playing cards, tennis, football, baseball, cricket, and the bicycle craze in the 1890s, and disapproved of sports, cheering teams, and college swimming pools in 1912. During a picnic held at Avondale College in 1899, she was greatly upset to see the students playing cricket. Quote, "And while men were playing the game of cricket," she wrote, "Satan was playing the game of life for their souls." Close quote. However, the Avondale cricket coach strongly disagreed with Mrs. White. In a similar vein, General Conference President John Byington and Review editor Uriah Smith wrote articles opposing baseball, football, and croquet. Yet Ellen White gave toy trains to children. John Byington went fishing with his grandkids. Smith bought his son Parker Smith a baseball. And Signs of the Times editor Ellet Wagner played tiddlywinks and parlor games with his daughters. Despite official disapproval, organized sports proliferated in the late 19th century. In Battle Creek, the Review and Herald baseball team played the Advance Shops and Foundry team in 1887. In the 1890s, Battle Creek College, Union College, Healdsburg College, and the Keene Institute in Texas fielded football and baseball teams, while Avondale College sponsored cricket and tennis teams. Nevertheless, when Adventists purchased the Loma Linda Sanitarium property in 1905, Ellen White expressed absolute certainty that the large billiard table, which had cost hundreds of dollars, would soon be disposed of. One wonders if a liberal California family of Adventists dared to purchase it. Likewise, despite their parents' disapproval, Edson White captained a baseball team, and Parker Smith played football and baseball for the Battle Creek College team against the Battle Creek Sanitarium and the Review and Herald teams when both of these boys were teenagers. But by 1901, Ellen White's disapproval of organized games spurred college presidents to turn sports fields into vegetable gardens. In place of games, she recommended manual labor, picnics, and outdoor pursuits. Not until the 1920s were students at Emmanuel Missionary College allowed to play baseball and volleyball, but only on festive occasions. But over in Battle Creek, Adventists in the 1920s enjoyed mixed swimming and boating, pitching quarts, playing badminton and croquet, and even attending Halloween parties that lasted past midnight. By the 1930s, EMC's male students gained the right to play basketball, volleyball, softball, and ping pong, while mixed groups enjoyed roller skating, volleyball, softball, and occasionally other games. By the 1950s, EMC's males could play intramural sports, but not intercollegiate games or tackle football. Well, the girls, of course, watched it all from the bleachers. Consequently, 20th century Adventism reflected a schizophrenic attitude towards sports. The church officially discouraged commercial sports, card games, checkers, chess, dominoes, and Monopoly, for wasting time. It frowned upon billiards and bowling for their immoral associations. Yet Bible, nature, and word card games were instructive, and pickup ball games were recreational, if not carried to excess. But if some leaders opposed intercollegiate games, others seemed to favor them. And 78% of Adventist youth disagreed with bans on intercollegiate sports. For example, in 1988, General Conference Director of Education George Akers, Southern College of Seventh-day Adventist President Don Solly, Andrews University President Richard Lesher, and Chair of the PE Department at Andrews University John Pangman opposed intercollegiate sports. But Andrews University Vice President of Development David Fainer, Director of the SDA Health Association Walter Hammerslough, and President of the SDA PE and Recreation Association Duck Newberry strongly favored intercollegiate sports. Despite this contention, by the 1980s, 80% of Adventist colleges belonged to the National Intercollegiate Athletic Association or the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and fielded teams in soccer, basketball, football, volleyball, softball, or track. Only Southern Adventist University and Southwestern Adventist University did not join the NAIA or the FCA. In addition, 25 Adventist academies also participated in inter-school sports. Yet church leaders, some of whom were reported to play rook at constituency meetings, forbade the Public Affairs and Religious Liberty Department from defending players who protested that Saturday night games violated their religious freedom. Furthermore, church officials who frowned on inter-school sports competition applauded when Pathfinder groups competed in marching drills, knot-tying contests, and Pinewood Derby races. Nonetheless, a few Adventists have been notable for their contributions to sports and to gaming. Adventist physician Frank Jobe, who served for 40 years as the team doctor for the Los Angeles Dodgers, pioneered the Tommy John surgical procedure, which takes a ligament from a player's good elbow and uses it to repair a torn ulnar collateral ligament in his pitching arm. It is reported that 1/3 of major league pitchers have undergone this procedure.
Check your computer. You've got something kicked up there.
Oh. You technological wizards, if you can take that off. I didn't notice that was going on. All right. Thank you, Kathy.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do.
See what you can do. 1/3 of major league pitchers have undergone this procedure. In 2014, the Grateful Dodgers named their training facility for Mr. Jobe. If sports harm the body, gambling, often associated with dance halls, saloons, bowling alleys, billiard rooms, and houses of prostitution, endangered the soul. Ellen White condemned gambling as Satan's invention. She rebuked Adventists who prayed before tossing coins to make major decisions. Likewise, evangelist John Loughborough was bewildered when he was working in Reno, Nevada, where Adventists in the 1870s began replacing gambling on checkers and chess with a topical Bible game that they played incessantly for 4 consecutive meetings. He concluded that Nevadan Adventists were by nature addicted to gaming. Today, the church opposes gambling as a violation of Christian stewardship and as a practice that is antisocial, uneconomic, and addictive. The Seventh-day Adventist Encyclopedia condemns gambling as a habit that promotes selfishness, covetousness, and greed, and a practice that makes chance the basis of one's conduct. Nonetheless, I have known a few Adventists who engage in recreational gambling, and a handful who assist in the operation of Native American casinos at various places in the United States, and my alma mater academy, which has accepted over $1 million of that casino money. Yes, that will go nameless. Dime novels, which harmed the mind, had been condemned by Baptists and Methodists for their sentimentality, emotionally stimulating nature, anti-Christian themes, and focus on crime, sex, and violence. Mrs. White forbade reading sentimental, sensational, erotic, profane, and trashy literature because doing so was addictive, wasted time, and unfit the mind for serious study. And yet, she encouraged the youth to read John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress and Sabbath Readings for the Home Circle, an 1863 compilation of uplifting stories, but not all of them true. Uriah Smith, who opposed novels that poison the mind and destroy a taste for all that is wholesome, useful, and true, warned members that they must answer in the day of judgment for time wasted on such trash. Paradoxically, however, Uriah Smith in the 1890s taught classes at Battle Creek College in the classical BA degree program, which was a 7-year program, by the way, which was steeped in Greek and Roman mythology. He also printed in the Review Evangelist Dudley M. Kenwright's recommendation that Adventist children should read Uncle Tom's Cabin, Robinson Crusoe, and a list of 9 other fictional works. Edson White, the son of James and Ellen White, also read fictional storybooks and surreptitiously practiced target shooting with an air gun at Battle Creek's amusement arcade. Nor did Mrs. White remove the imported fireplace tiles depicting King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, which surrounded her fireplace at Elmshaven, her retirement home in California. But it greatly upset her in the 1890s when the Review and Herald Press published dime novels, Wild West stories, romances, and books promoting Catholic teachings, hypnosis, and witchcraft. She warned the editor, Uriah Smith, to get rid of such trash of satanic origin. When the publishing board ignored her, Ellen White urged Review and Herald workers to go on strike. And she predicted a divine cleansing by fire, which came, as you know, in December of 1902, when the press burned to the ground. Consequently, when the golden age of children's literature dawned in the 1920s, Adventists compromised by producing inspirational fiction, such as Arthur S. Maxwell's mystery story, The Secret of the Cave, in 1920, and later his 10-volume set on the Bible stories, which were wildly popular between 1951 and 58 as they came off the press, and by 1983 they had sold over 63 million copies. Jerry Thomas's Detective Zack series proved wildly popular in the 1990s, as did apocalyptic adult fiction, such as Mary Kay McLeod's Now, June Strong's Project Sunlight, Ken Wade's Orion Conspiracy, and Edward Eggleston's End of the World. If novels per se were no longer prohibited at boarding academies after the 1950s, J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books were banned in all Adventist elementary and secondary schools for their emphasis on violence, ghosts, poltergeists, witches, wizards, spells, and curses. Yet many boards approved C.S. Lewis's Narnia series and J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings set because, in their words, the violence aptly highlighted the great controversy between good and evil. Finally, a decade ago, Adventist novelist David Duncan argued that fiction opens to us truths that would be inaccessible otherwise, and thus fills our lives with meaning. Christians of all denominations condemned theaters, which portrayed fictional dramas on stage and featured prostitution, alcoholism, pickpockets. Likewise, vaudeville combined Shakespearean themes with burlesque, blackface, minstrelsy, dances, acrobatics, and pantomimes. Also featured at some of the vaudevillian shows were reenactments of stabbings, shootings, hangings, poisonings, suicides, and even train wrecks. Even upper-class operas highlighted violence, passion, and lust. Ellen White, who condemned the theater as the very hotbed of immorality, warned members not to subject themselves to its temptations, which included low songs, lewd gestures, immoral settings, indecent content, and scenes of drinking, gambling, dancing, and card playing that debased the morals, depraved the imagination, destroyed religious impressions, and blunted a relish for real life. From its founding in 1874, Battle Creek College had forbidden students to attend local billiard halls, saloons, skating rinks, and gambling dens. In 1890, the faculty added theaters to that list. Yet many Battle Creek Adventists in the 1880s and 90s attended theatrical plays. And while Uriah Smith condemned circuses and theaters in the Review, his wife Harriet took their boys to the county fair for horse races and sideshows, and to Chicago by train for panoramas on the Civil War and the Siege of Paris in 1871. George Amidon, the head copy editor at the Review, took his daughters to circuses and magic lantern shows and to see the Cardiff Giant hoax. Ellen White's granddaughters, Ella and Mabel White, also attended magic lantern shows and followed the circus parades and calliopes, although they were forbidden to see the circus acts in the big tent. In the early 20th century, Adventist evangelists used colorful glass stereopticon slides to illustrate their sermons. By the 1940s, they were renting huge public theaters, such as Chicago's Lyric Theater, New York City's Carnegie Hall, and London's Colosseum Theater for their evangelistic crusades, places that Adventists had previously been forbidden to go. But with the advent of moving pictures in the 1890s, members were conditioned to see theaters as bad places, threats to family unity, full of violence and vulgarity, where evil was glamorized and spiritual values compromised. Adventist youth were warned that since the devil was inside the theater, the Holy Spirit and the guardian angels could not enter. This quickly gave rise to an Adventist joke that the safest place to be on earth was at the entrance to the cinema because so many angels were congregated there. So boarding academies from the 1920s to the present have forbidden students to go to cinemas or watch theater movies on VCRs, DVD players, and laptops in the dorms. No films rated higher than PG at academies or PG-13 at colleges can be shown on most campuses today. At some Adventist colleges in the 1950s, students who went to the cinema were blacklisted and given a final warning before being expelled. Instead, the faculty invited Stan Midgley, Sam Campbell, and Don Cooper to show nature and skiing films on Saturday nights. But thousands of Adventists flocked to academy and college campuses in the 1960s to see The Sound of Music, a movie that Dr. Scott Moncrief, who is present with us today, asserted lies at the heart of Adventist cultural literacy because it focuses on children, was wholesome, uplifting entertainment, reminded them of their own childhood, and featured familiar Adventist motifs such as fleeing to the hills and the mountains from persecution. Adventists suppressed desire to march and dance, and tension between the individual and the church or state. Consequently, dozens of academy senior classes chose Climb Every Mountain for their graduation class song. Dr. Moncrief encouraged Adventists to see more foreign and independent films, to analyze the movies they saw, to talk with their friends about them, and to read books about films. Recent Adventist film critics have applauded movies for teaching truth, respect, love, beauty, and Christian beliefs in fresh ways. They have suggested that good films can be evangelistic, create culturally connected Christian communities, express our common experiences and shared memories, keep our hopes alive, and articulate our deepest concerns. Consequently, although the 1990 Church Manual warned against the sinister influence of the theater, in a 1992 survey, 64% of Adventist youth felt that it was okay to go to the theater, and 96% had no problem watching movies on a TV, VCR, or DVD player at home. In 2003, Southern Adventist University, the first church educational institution to establish a school of visual art and design, produced the movie Angel in Chains, the first Adventist-made film to achieve commercial viability. The following year, Adventist movie producer Terry Benedict's film biography of Desmond Doss, The Conscientious Objector, appeared. Movie mogul Martin Doblmeyer has made at least three films about Adventists: The Adventist in 2010, The Adventist 2 in 2013, and The Blueprint in 2013. In 2017, actor and producer Mel Gibson directed Hacksaw Ridge, a rather violent movie about Adventist conscientious objector and Congressional Medal of Honor winner Desmond Doss. But when televisions began appearing in homes after 1950, pastors, teachers, and parents feared they would bring the theater into the home. Articles in the Review and the Youth Instructor criticized TV for wasting time, showcasing sex, violence, and the occult, causing a decrease in viewers' vocabularies, family communication, church attendance, Bible study, family worship, restful sleep, and homework completion, contributing to a rise in obesity, tooth decay, cardiovascular disease, eye problems, noisy behavior, cynicism, and juvenile delinquency. Many, in fact, predicted that TV would cause addicted viewers emotional and psychological harm, foster greed and materialism, create alcoholics and lawbreakers, and lead to a rise in divorce and illegitimate births. Adventists in Puerto Rico and Adventists in the German Reform Movement even considered it a sin to own a radio or a TV. Yet just as HMS Richards with the Tabernacle of the Air and J.L. Tucker with the Quiet Hour had focused evangelistic applications for radio in the 1930s and 40s, other pioneers found new witnessing techniques using TV. In 1950, William and Virginia Fagel started Faith for Today, a live 30-minute broadcast featuring stories, religious drama, short talks, quartet music, and a Bible correspondence course from a studio in New York City. In 1958, George Vandeman's It Is Written TV broadcast targeted urban audiences with a weekly mix of Adventist doctrines, health, and felt needs programs that won 17 Angel Awards. Beginning in 1973, C.D. Brooks hosted Breath of Life, a weekly TV program targeting black audiences with fervent preaching and singing by the Breath of Life Quartet. Adventist Hispanic TV programs, including Aldea in 1972 to 77, Ayer Hoy Mañana 1975 to 93, La Voz 1984 to the present, And KSBN Safe Television for All Ages, 1993 to the present, have also been evangelistic. In 1986, Danny Shelton created a self-supporting TV network, the Three Angels Broadcasting Network, or 3ABN, based in Thompsonville, Illinois, that showcased recorded church services, evangelistic series, children's shows, health discussions, and family-focused programs. Adventists also utilized satellite TV to target global audiences for the Net 95 through Net 99 evangelistic series. Reversing a century of negative attitudes toward film, in 2002, the North American Division sponsored the first Sunscreen Film Festival to encourage Adventist college youth to produce uplifting films. To this date, students from Andrews University, Southern Adventist University, and Pacific Union College have garnered the most awards for these films. In addition, by 2005, at least a dozen TV celebrities were Adventist or had connections with Adventists, including Little Richard, Prince, Art Buchwald, Joan London, Cliff Davis, Leonard Bailey, George Vandeman, Linda Shelton, Doug Batchelor, Del Delker, Ben Carson, and the Chamberlains. Finally, although Oprah Winfrey has no ties to Adventism, her show has inspired some within the Adventist Church to emulate many of her techniques. Changing lives through positive TV, removing Adventist cliches from the Hope Channel, avoiding sermon-style preaching, focusing on entertainment and fun content, inspiring people to change their lives, having a clear vision of the target audience's needs, convincing people we care about them and their needs, hiring media specialists to help with software and funding, being authentic in portraying real lives and not perfect people, and being willing to spend millions of dollars to produce top-notch TV programs. Well, folks, this concludes part one. In part two, we will explore the following topics on April 29. Adventist lifestyles regarding dancing, sexual mores, dress, jewelry, music, temperance, diet, sanitariums versus hospitals, health foods, and fads. I invite you to return. Thank you very much.
Wow, Brian, when you promised facts, insights, and surprises, you did not disappoint. I had a question for you, but I'm going to save it because it relates to diet and to your love of dark chocolate.
But oh, yes.
Since you mentioned diet comes on April 29,
it's important to get your antioxidants. Yes.
Despite the devilish xanthines, we'll discuss. Okay, if any of you have questions, we have two mics roving. Please put up your hands, and we'll bring the mic to you. Okay, let's start on that side, and then I'll...
You talked about the four streams of Adventism. How do you see those four streams playing within your lifestyle presentation?
Well, I would say this. Your progressive Adventists are willing to make some what we might call compromises. I've dealt with that in my presentation, and see the good in some of these cultural practices. The historic Adventists probably draw a very stiff line and say, no, if it wasn't approved of by Ellen White, then we're not going to do it today. Mainstream Adventists, which I presume is probably the largest group, will try to take a middle-of-the-road view between the progressive Adventist and historic Adventist and, change a little bit from time to time according to circumstances. Let's see, now you know you've got me. What was the fourth one?
It's your streams.
Okay, there are four streams, but it's historic,
progressive,
mainstream, historic, mainstream, progressive, and Evangelical, thank you. Evangelical, yes. Would want to see, is this really advancing my spiritual lifestyle? You know, is this helping me grow spiritually? You know, bringing me closer to Jesus and to the church? Is it you know, harming my witness before non-Adventists and so forth? So, you know, I mean, you could take any one of them, you know, and say, well, all right, a card playing, a progressive Adventist might say, well, you know, I see no harm in that. We're just killing time, you know, just filling in a little time. And I did get on rather good authority my statement, which was not off the top of my head, that some church leaders do play rook at constituency meetings. So don't call me a heretic for that. I read it in print. And say, well, you know, we're just killing time. Others would say, no, Ellen White condemned playing cards, so therefore we shouldn't play cards at all. And others would say, well, you know, it's all right to play a little blackjack at the casino here in our area. It's just, you know, killing time, and, you know, I'm helping the Native Americans out with my donations. you know, you can look at it in various ways, and I think these four streams of Adventism would look at it in different ways, you know, that way. Yeah.
Brian, I know that it wasn't within your lecture to talk about rationalists and romantics in Europe, but yet we heard a lot about Uriah Smith and some of the other people being rationalists.
Yes.
Do you find in your literature references to these people in Europe that are associated with the Enlightenment and the Romantic movement being cited as reasons for doing this or that? My suspicion is that they're basically governed by metaphors, and they really don't have any knowledge of the critical aspects of the reasoning that they're going through. That may be a true or a false observation.
Well, I think my response is just going to thrill your heart, liver, and kidneys. You got your PhD in Scotland, didn't you?
Yeah.
An article I have yet to write, but I've been thinking about it, is the connection between our Seventh-day Adventist pioneers and the Scottish common sense.
Oh, yeah.
Field of reading. Absolutely. Yeah. It's plain as the nose on your face, that they were strongly, Uriah Smith particularly, strongly influenced by this Enlightenment strain called common sense philosophy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Adam Ferguson and others in Scotland, it infiltrated America in the early 19th century. Our Enlightenment, you know, we talk about the Enlightenment in Europe being 18th century. Our Enlightenment here in America, the American Enlightenment, lasted down into the 1840s. So it was still influencing. William Miller was strongly influenced by the Scottish Enlightenment common sense school.
And you find references to this, do you?
I find that the way they reason lines up perfectly with the Scottish common sense school. They may not realize, I mean, these are not college educated men. You know, for the most part, most of our Adventist pioneers had elementary educations through the eighth grade, a few of them through the 12th grade, but not many. They don't realize, you know, what they're doing, what they're imbibing. But the Scottish common sense rationalism basically teaches, as Uriah Smith did, that anything that can be comprehended by the mind, comprehended by the senses, taste, touch, and so forth, is real. It's real. If it's, you know, capable of being defined by reason and by the senses, then it is real. And that's Scottish common sense philosophy. I studied that at the University of Iowa when I was taking my European intellectual courses, intellectual history courses. Mm-hmm. It's an article that needs to be written. Nobody has written it yet, and I guess I'm probably the one that should.
One thing about casinos and Indians,
I
grew up on a reservation, and gambling is as it's ingrained into the Indian culture as potlucks are in Adventism.
I have pointed this out to my alma mater, and they have demurred.
Brian?
I have tried to point out to them that they're taking tainted money, but they don't see it that way. So, Aura, next question.
Brian, yeah. This is way different.
Yeah.
But about halfway through your presentation, you mentioned a woman who did somebody's remedies. I can't remember her first name. Elizabeth's remedies? Anyway, she made millions making, or lots of money making this anti-cholera remedy that contained, among other things, white snake root and laudanum. And those are both really poisonous. So I'm very surprised. Do you know anything? Can you expand anything more on her, or that just something in passing?
Well, I thought you were going to ask, are you sure that James and Ellen White tried it? Oh. No. We don't have proof of that, but we do know that she gave it to them. Cholera was something much more prevalent, as you're aware, I'm sure, in the 19th century than it is now. So it may have been something they kept in their medicine cabinet, so to speak.
But I mean, it's so poisonous. I mean, cholera is you die of diarrhea. Yeah. So, yeah, maybe it's just a race of kills the bugs before it kills you or something.
Well, we hope so. She sold it widely across the United States. It is amazing. And spicy kubeb, brother, that's hot on the tongue. That's very hot on the tongue. That's a hot pepper plant from the Caribbean, I think, or maybe Far East. But anyway, yeah, the blend of items that she put into that, I wouldn't even want to smell it, much less taste it. Yes, sir.
You mentioned postum being a product that kind of crosses the culture between Mormonism and Adventism. Yeah. Are there other examples of big cultural overlap or official recognition between Adventism and any other American religions?
With regard to diet, you mean?
In general. I mean, postum's a pretty specific product.
Yes.
But are there other examples like postum through history where there's something that kind of overlaps between Adventism and another American culture?
Well, I'll tell you, I was often confused with Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons because when I was a student canvasser for 5 summers, we went 2x2 on the street. So did the Mormons, so did the Jehovah's Witnesses. And I had to learn to read the facial expressions of the person behind the door because there are so many Mormons in upstate central New York that, you know, if I saw a frown, I knew they weren't a Mormon. I said, no, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, you know. But Jehovah's Witnesses aren't that well-liked, I have to say, in upstate New York anyway. But I learned that as a Seventh-day Adventist, you know, I could relate to the Mormons that I met, because, you know, we both had some extra biblical literature. They have Joseph Smith, we have Ellen White. You know, they don't drink coffee, and we discourage the drinking of coffee as well. The Mormons are great dancers. That's one big difference between Mormon young people at Brigham Young University, what we discourage our students from doing here. But, you know, I once traded a Mormon woman a copy of Steps to Christ, which we sold for 50 cents, for a Book of Mormon, which she sold for 50 cents. So we just swapped books, you know. I hope she read more of Steps to Christ. I tried. I gave it an honest try. It's the dullest, boring. If you're having trouble sleeping, get a copy of the Book of Mormon. It's like trying to read Leviticus. Oh, my goodness. But anyway, you know, I went to their big sound and light show there, you know, Hill Cumorah, and they're very temperate people. We could talk diet. We could talk all kinds of lifestyle issues with the Mormons. Yeah. Yeah. Good, clean-cut young people, you know. The men, young men with their white shirts and their dark ties, they look like us. Student call boarders, going door to door.
Any last question? Many of us have been around for decades, and yes. I noticed a lot of reminiscing going on during your lecture, a lot of heads nodding and a lot of recognition. Come back April 29, and we'll do part two.
Now, you said you had a question that you were going to hold till the end.
Well, I was going to hold it until April 29.
Oh, till April 20. Okay.
Because it has to do with
the topic.
Our favorite dark chocolate.
Okay.
Thanks for coming. See you April 29. Thank you, Dr. Strayer.